As Johnny Carson said one time, it's nice to get up here before the applause stops. And I'll tell you, I was running. I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Jimmy, for inviting me in this terrific series. It's just been a real pleasure to be here as an audience member, and it's really nice to be reading here tonight, and I'm really honored to be reading with such great poets, Walt Peterson and Judith Getty, Judith Robinson, who is not only an excellent poet, but also an excellent editor. And a good friend of Pittsburgh poetry. I thought that I would. I was lucky enough to be invited by Judith to edit Margaret Menemann's second collection, "The Snow Falls Up." And let me tell you, I was knocked out. She is just a remarkable poet. She's just terrific, a formalist, but in many forms, and someone who sees a lot of life. Is able to analyze it and turn it into wonderful, wonderful fun and serious poetry. So I'd like to read a couple of her book or a couple of her poems, starting with one of her favorite forms was the sonnet, and I'm going to start off here with. It's good even from the right from the beginning. Sonnet number one. This is the kind of stuff that I think is so hard to write, and she's so good at it. Sonnet number one. I only meant to taste your laughing mouth and turn again, untroubled by your light, to my unchanging log of day and night, my safe geography of north and south. One sweet wild taste, I said, however splendid, and I will turn away. Oh, how mistaken was I, who left your arms afraid and shaken, unable to recall what I intended. So is the addict maid, who marks each day and tells each rosary by what he craves. Such is the lot of opium-driven slaves, who left unguarded will not run away. So is the fly by the honey snared, the same the moth that rushes back to die in flame. All right, Margaret. She's something, isn't she? One more sonnet here I couldn't resist. We've all had that sense of wanting to know everything about the person, our love, the person that we love, but at the same time aware of the necessity of mystery. This is number four. Now is no quiet in my wicked heart, once having seen like lightning on your face one brilliant, brief, illuminating trace of that wild secret self you hold apart and take with you alone to quiet haunts and share with none but the wind and field and stone. Once having glimpsed you totally alone, my heart is stung by beauty, and it wants your solitude laid open in my path that I might walk the corners of your soul and pause and touch and marvel at the whole. But knowing such exposure would be death, like any peeping Tom, I take your measure unseen so I do not destroy my treasure. Nice, nice stuff, yeah. She was something. Yeah, she deserves that. A great person and a great poet. This is one of her early poems that I just like the theme of. It's just really nice. It's called Butterflies. Try our unproven patented butterfly removal. Satisfaction guaranteed or your tummy back. All you have to do is swallow the recommended dosage of black and white. Let it settle into your system. Take no risks, don't laugh out loud, don't walk in the rain, don't love without license, don't question anything they tell you, don't wonder who you are, where you are. You'll never see another butterfly or have another dizzy rainbow day. And friend, I can guarantee you'll never feel another flutter or much of anything else. She was something, huh? I was struck by this one. She has a series of poems on working people. blue-collar workers. And I think that's, as we all know, an area that isn't often covered by poetry, although there are some great people, you know, our own Jim Daniels and Philip Levine and so forth. But I'm particularly fond of this, the woman on the construction crew. I'd have believed her in a gingham shift, starred with small daisies, floating white on blue, blue as the cornflower eyes she turned on you, merry with mischief, sudden, sweet, and swift, as children singing. Pigtails, pale as hay, dangling below her helmet when she stepped, no, danced to where the workers' tools were kept, picked up a shovel, and began her day. A tiny creature, wearing make-believe, she was adrift inside her coveralls, not built for digging drains and building walls. Yet there she was, as self-assured as Eve, making her way among those sinewy guys, at ease, at work, with those astonishing eyes. And there's a very, very fond of a series she does on angels. I mean, who writes poems about angels, right? They're just charming, magical pieces. And this is, and you know, they come to her house and disrupt everything and then leave. And this is angel number 10, they're leaving. They have gone, and good riddance. There isn't much privacy with a household of angels tangled up in your eyelashes and peeking into your ears. Sometime in the night, they faded away like late summer. My life has returned to normal. My sanity and profanity are intact. Still, there are little things. Several lost buttons have reattached to their garments, and the curtains dance rapturously even when there is no breeze. The bread rises without yeast. The house is as empty as a desert. Silence presses on me like a vice, except when I boil water and the tea kettle sings, Gloria, Gloria. That's sweet. Wonderful stuff. So, thanks, guys. That's available for sale afterwards, and unfortunately, Margaret is not available to sign, but they're here and they're great. I am also, of course, interested in your purchasing perhaps another book. If you need somebody to sign it, I'm right here. It's called Irish Coffee. I want to thank Mike Sims for producing such a great book, and for a lot of people here who have helped me, both as models and as editors in producing it. I obviously have some Irish background, and I would actually like to start to read the title poem. I got the idea of this, actually much of the poem, from a friend of mine I was having breakfast with, who's another Irish guy, about something that was happening in his family that wasn't very great. Irish Coffee. He sits with me at breakfast and tells the horrifying story about his brother's drinking and stealing, arrested with the saliva still staining the rifle barrel. For we are Irish, dreamy stallions with bloodlines that take us back to lost races, to the knowledge that sooner or later the world will break our hearts, for we know the world of dreams far better than is good. We know its whiskey surge, how it gathers to unleash the wizard of our heart's tongue in a patriot game, our loss on the water lapping at Innisfree. I want to be horrified by his brother's excesses, express sympathy, disgust, but I'm envious of his plans. Take, shoot. After my breakfast, I lift coffee for a sip, already planning for still another before it chills. My mother was a part of a large Irish family. There were seven sisters and a couple of brothers. She was a kind of remarkable person. She was, all the aunts were really nice to us, but she was sort of the disciplinarian. And it turned out she was not only that, she was the responsible one who, she was with every one of her sisters who died. She was a nurse. And then she died and there were no sisters. I went to see her, and it was very moving for me. Last visit to my aunt. I looked down at the dying aunt, the anthropology of my Celtic history, and see my mother's and my own skull staring back at me. Beautiful hair gone knotted to a question mark. Is that papier-mâché mask telling me some secret in the mysterious unbroken word stream that could be a keening for lost sisters, a story from before I understood words? 100 runic prayers run together for their eternity in the airy alleys of her heaven, with its one incomprehensible God. I add one more plea. Please get me out of here. I can offer nothing now, and never really could, except a hand to a stronger one, helping me perhaps across the street or squeezing goodbye on a train to camp. I sneak my fingers away and watch her hand rise like a crippled duck, now swimming somehow smoothly into a glorious swan, her wake finally empty of signets. Thank you. Thanks, guys. And since I'm on this theme of influential Irish people, I can't let go any further without mentioning my brother. Terrific person that he was, powerful personality, looked out for me for years, but of course we all know sibling lives are not absolutely smooth. So this is based on a present he gave me one time, which was a checkbook cover and a billfold. It's called Check. I stare at the final shreds of my old checkbook. Little damage can still be done to the fray of sleek alligator hide that was my brother's love, belt hard and smooth, covering my loose spending. As a child, he stole all my dresser change, quickly spending it to nothing. Later, he learned to turn a buck like kicking a bothersome leaf in the cold wind. Finding faith in every sad thing my father told him, he tried to invest it back in me, never to sell capital, never to buy on margin, never to co-sign what you can't pay, always to talk of money. He never hit me after I was 12, neither for the way I mocked him, nor how I stole back my time from him, even as his check still floated me. I take out from the billfold a photograph of my brother next to me, formal dark suits, serious faces, very much in the bandit tradition. I spent some time in West Virginia. I loved it. I just thought it was such a terrific place. They were such good people. I had a number of memories from down there, and this is one of them. Actually, it's kind of two folded together, a West Virginia memory. Even in the early 60s, it was like going back in time, not primordial, but when you cut a hard mountain right, you were lost in that God swamp of endless foliage. One of those turns, they used to say, God Hank Williams at 29, not far from here, despite those great gospel songs. And I wanted it. The absurd million-year beauty of what wasn't blown up by the coal owners and those minefields, the too many miners in the bars at 11 a.m. because of a coal glut and their own irascibility. 2 years now, just waiting for them to open. I'll keep mining. I wanted even the feuds, polite, then deadly. And the Fairmont Ramp Festival that Tom's grandfather Bab didn't go to because he got no personal invitation for the first time in 30 years. Wasn't sufficiently urged, he said. And stopping off at a contest or the dances advertised on those small, waist-high, portable billboards, that music from hundreds of years ago to my gut today, guitars, fiddles, banjos, even a man named Billy Banjo, Archie Jones and his 12-string, all playing our Appalachian heritage, the music of the aging spine of our East. West Virginia is the only state that still legalizes snake handling, but also had the only person who seemed to understand the Vietnam War, my bartender, Sleepy. Late Honest to God, outsized window, framing the glistening Monongahela River, after my physical for the draft, after the blended whiskey salesman left. Sleepy said, if they want to send them sons of bitches over here and give me a gun, I'll shoot them, but I'll be goddamned if I'm going over there. wasn't that the whole thing? That was it. Yeah. How many of you know Mary Worth? Oh, yeah. Big fans. All right. Well, I took a drawing of figure class one time and was told and learned by experience how tough it is to draw hands. And all the hands in Mary Worth are perfect. But it's what Mary does with her hands that is so great. The hands of Mary Worth. Once when my son was breaking apart, my wife held him briefly and took his face into her hands and smoothed it to its youthful faith. Of all the absurd things we ask women to do, soothing is perhaps the most amazing, drawing us towards them, assuring us that death is an illusion, that we belong in the world in their comforting hands. The master artists best capture that touch. But if you are away from the galleries, look at the daily comic pages and see worthy Mary express, console, countless neighbors, palm on breast, fingers on throat, care radiating out of beautiful hands, carrying the most overlooked gospel in all the news. I want to read a couple new poems, if that's okay, because I don't want you to think I've just been snoozing ever since I got Mike in to publish this. This is a poem I've been fooling with for a while. Let me know what you think. It's called Baroque. I remember the hollow cross above my mother's bed and the day it opened to me accidentally. Me playing, although perhaps all was snooping. The back slid off like castors gone wild, and death fixing stared back at me. Candles, oils, neat on tiny shelves. They, fronted by a golden dying Jesus, were to get one of us through, across the river to the other side. Baroque, they say, comes from the Spanish word for egg. OED says it's a rough or Scotch pearl. A struggle to get out like 17th century prose, sometimes set free awkwardly and often pushing too much whimsical ornamentation. There's murder in love through neglect, fist, finger, tool, and maybe what you're thinking right now. My rages, deceptions, desert inside, the doctor says I, maybe you, should know, like a released egg's first sizzle in a hot pan. Hi, thanks. And finally, I'd like to read a poem that was published by Rune this year. I want to thank those of you who have submitted to Rune and encourage you to continue to do so. We really think we're getting a better and better magazine every year, and we're very happy with your submissions. So I got this idea from a gardener. I don't usually hang around with gardeners, but this gardener said that there was a problem, and I thought I had the answer to it, and it turned out I didn't, and then I supposed something else, and all of a sudden it occurred to me, this is like those SAT questions we all used to have to answer. Incredibly stupid. So, this is called SAT question. Going up the wrangling road, I see an infestation of bamboo that threatens all the other vegetation. This is serious, my gardening friend tells me. A. I suggest a herd of pandas, set them loose at the top of the road, near the nice duplexes that could house pandas, and then let them eat their way all the way down to the ice cream store for an arranged reward slake. The bamboo looks kind of dry. B. No, my friend tells me definitely, for two reasons. It's not the kind of bamboo they like, and there aren't enough pandas in captivity to form such a herd. Answer the following questions. 1. Ignoring the ice cream and the gardener's attitude, does it matter if either A or B are true? Why or why not? Not right? 2. Why does China have all the pandas? Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Great.